This podcast brought to you by Aviation Consumer Magazine, the consumer resource for pilots and aircraft owners.
Hi everyone, this is Kate O'Connor reporting for AvWeb. I'm here today with filmmakers Derek Greer and Ron King from the Humanist Documentary Film Foundation. Gentlemen, thank you for being here today.
Thank you.
Now, you've just released the museum cut of your World War I aviation documentary, The Millionaires Unit. For those who aren't familiar with the story, what was the Millionaires Unit?
The Millionaires Unit was a group of Yale undergraduates in 1916 who formed a privately funded air militia in preparation for World War I. The person that founded it is a guy named Truby Davison, and his father was J.P. Morgan's business partner. And therefore, they had enough money to basically get trained as aviators and prepare themselves to fly in World War I. So the Yale unit, or as they later became known, the Millionaires Unit through the New York Press, were basically these young guys from Yale who set up this flying corps and then eventually got into the Navy after they had set up their own group.
They were flying these little Curtiss F boats, which were planes that took off from and landed on the water. And they kept trying to get the Navy to recognize them. I think they had foresight, thinking that planes and aviation were going to be important in the military, but the Navy just couldn't wrap their heads around it. The planes were rather flimsy. They couldn't carry much. They were dangerous, and the Navy didn't want to give up their ships just to be able to hold all of these little flying boats. But when the United States finally went to war, the Navy said, boy, we need something. And they looked around and realized the first Yale unit guys were almost the only guys that really knew how to fly. There were maybe 50 other Navy aviators scattered around, and they said, glad you guys are here. They all thought they were going to go to Europe and fly together as a squadron, but since they were needed everywhere. So they were split up, training other pilots, flying experimental aircraft. Some went with the RAF, flying for the British, and they were dispersed through France. Very few of them actually flew together, but they had a profound impact on the Navy and aviation during the war.
So how did you come to choose this particular story to turn into a film?
In about 2007, I was in a bookstore and noticed a new stack of books. And I had, for some reason, was drawn to it. I walked over to this new stack of books and noticed that there was a photograph on the cover of one of the new releases. And there was a picture of my grandfather on the cover of the book that I had never seen before, but I recognized him right away. He was with a group of other young people. And I noticed the title of the book was The Millionaires Unit, and I immediately knew what the story was about, because my mother had told me that my grandfather had flown in World War I and was one of the first U.S. naval aviators, but I really didn't know the story. I didn't know what the story was about his service in World War I, and here was a brand new book that was coming out that told the story. So it was kind of a happenstance discovery on my part, which began the whole process of making the documentary.
So when did you actually start filming?
Well, it took a bit of preparation to get ready to start filming. The first thing that needed to happen was to find a filmmaking group. Well, actually, before that even happened, I was got in touch with the author of the book, Mark Wortman. And he invited me to come sit on a panel at the Yale Club in New York. The first question that I had for Mark Wortman was, is anyone making a documentary about this story? And he told me that no one was, to his knowledge. And it was at that point that my interest was sparked in wanting to make a documentary. And I got in touch with Derek Greer about it. Derek, who we're talking to right now, was an old friend of mine from college, and a professional documentarian already. and had a career doing that. When we got together, we sat down and talked about it. Derek read the book, and the two of us decided to make it into a documentary. As far as filming goes, we started basically with very, very little in terms of resources, very little money. So when we first started filming, we had maybe one or two people on the crew. For example, I did some of the early interviews as a one-person operation. Typically, you have a minimum of three people on a shoot for something like that, but we did it basically by the bootstraps from the beginning. But at the same time, we formed a nonprofit organization, and we began to reach out to some of the people who had expressed interest to start to raise some money so that we could actually finance some of the work that we were doing. That all began sometime after the event at the Yale Club in New York with Mark Wortman.
Well, when Ron was at the Yale Club, he met several other family members, most of them on the East Coast there. And they all said that they had private collections of photographs that hadn't really been seen before. And I thought we could make, at the very least, sort of a nice little family film, you know, going through the photograph album, bringing these family members together and interviewing them. And we should look at some archival footage of World War One, and maybe we could make a nice little known story. But at the same time, we looked around for World War One planes, and it turned out in California, there was a collection. A gentleman had over two dozen World War One replica planes, but all with original engines. And we went to their annual fly-in. This is probably, 2009 maybe? And saw these planes, and particularly heard the engine of a Sopwith Camel, which is a rotary engine with nine cylinders that barks and bangs and sounds very distinctive. I really fell in love with this plane, and two of our characters flew Sopwith Camels. One of them became the Navy's only ace during World War One, and the other lost his life in a Sopwith Camel. And so we determined to find one to film. The owner did not want to film with his plane. He didn't want to rent helicopters and get up in the sky with it. And there were only two others in the world that flew. And one of the others was owned by Sir Peter Jackson in New Zealand. And we finally got in touch with them and let them know what we wanted to do and told them how much money we had. And they said, come on out. And so Ron and one of our producers, Harry Davison, and I went to New Zealand and rented some helicopters and a Cessna and got up in the air over about 5 days and filmed this beautiful, beautiful collection. And so all of a sudden, our film had really jumped up in scope. Instead of taking 2.5 years and maybe $300,000, it wound up taking 7 years and costing $1 million. But we were able to make a two-hour, rather epic film about what these guys did in World War One.
How closely did you end up working with Mark Wortman on this after the initial meeting there?
Well, Mark was very much a supporter of what we were doing from the get-go. He formed close relationships with all of the family members that he had interviewed up to that point in preparation for his book a few years before that. However, he hadn't interviewed anybody from my family, from the Voorhees family. And it turned out that my grandfather had a collection of about 200 letters from that period, from 1916, 17, and 18. And over the next couple of years, I ended up transcribing all of those letters. So we had quite a bit of more information in those letters. And Derek mentioned the other family archives that we discovered along the way. So we ended up getting a lot more archival information than Mark even had for his book.
I'd like to say that Ron's grandfather was the Samuel Pitt of the first Yale unit. He was a great diarist and wrote really funny letters. He was quite a witty guy.
Throughout the whole process, Mark was always supportive of what we were doing. And of course, we interviewed him extensively for the film at his home. And since then, he's been very involved in the process. He's been at many of our screenings. He's helped promote the film. So Mark's been a great, great supporter. And his book is amazing. I mean, when I read his book for the first time, I felt like I was standing next to my grandfather while he was going through all these things shortly after the turn of the last century.
We didn't want to just make a film about Mark's book, though. The Davison family of Troopy Davison, who started the unit, they hired another Yale student to write a history of the first Yale unit. And so in 1925, a double volume came out about it. And then also at the Sterling Library at Yale, the Troopy Davison papers have all of the correspondence in them. I don't want to spoil the story, but there's a reason that Truby did not go to Europe. And so all of his other friends, when they were overseas, were writing him letters. And so they talk about everything that everyone was going through. So on big dates, when one of the members died or when something happened, they all wrote about it and they all wrote home to Truby about it. And so we had this huge cache of information of how the story developed. And they talk about their love lives. They talk about how they flew their planes. They talk about how they feel about each other. And so we really did primary research to put the story together.
On that note, was there a particular fact or story you ran across while doing all of this that really sparked your interest or surprised you?
Close to the end of the process of the making the film, this is, we're talking 6 years in at this point, one of our producers, Harry Davison, who is the grandson of Truby Davison, was just up in his attic and pilfering through some of his own records and came across a photo album that he hadn't recognized, and opened it up. And there inside of this photo album were images from a trip that we had read about of Truby going to Alaska on a hunting expedition in about, I think it was it 1914 or 15?
Prior
to the formation of the Yale unit. And there, it was on this particular trip that Truby found out that the war had broken out in Europe from somebody that they, like a mountain man, that they had bumped into on the trail. So it was a significant moment for the story of Truby Davison. And there in Harry's attic, in an old scrapbook, were images from this exact trip. So in the film, you'll see photographs from that trip to Alaska, where Truby Davison first found out that World War I had broken out.
I can't think of anything in particular that surprised me, and I'm sure there were things, but I think the most amazing thing about going through the correspondence was just how young and human these guys were, and getting jealous of each other, missing their girlfriends, some telling the other ones, you better marry that girl, you better not, you know, forget about her. If you miss out, you're going to miss out. And there was such camaraderie around the guys. And it sort of seems like a rah-rah patriotic story of all these guys were brilliant and talented and could fly very well. But it wasn't true. There were several members of the unit that really should not have been aviators. And there was one in particular that should have given it up, but he didn't want to let his friends down. And he was really petrified. And we found his diary, and he really talks about how unsure he is and that he hopes he gets better. And then finally he's saying things like, well, the best thing that could happen to me is that I give the ultimate sacrifice, that I die in a training accident, because I'm really not going to be able to make it. And he wasn't able to let down his friends by saying, I shouldn't be flying. And indeed, he crashed in the harbor at Dunkirk and died. But he did it to support his friends. So there are countless moving stories, and I hope some of those come across in the film.
I can mention one other story that was surprising to me as we were making the movie, and that was, again, late in the process, we were working after the film had been edited, and we had discovered that the actor Bruce Dern was related to one of the aviators in our story, which was very, very interesting to find out. It turns out Bruce's middle name is McLeish, and McLeish, there were two McLeishes around at the time. There was Archibald McLeish, who later became the poet laureate of the United States, and his brother, his younger brother, Kenny McLeish, who was one of Truby Davison's classmates. He might have been a little bit younger, but he was one of the Yale unit members. And we were there recording with Bruce in the studio, and he pulled out his mobile phone, pulled up a photograph of a home in Illinois that had these turrets on the corners of the home. It looked a bit like a castle, these rounded sort of turrets on the edges of the home. And he pointed to a window and he said, "Do you see that window right there? I grew up in that room, and it also happened to be the same room that Kenny McLeish of the first Yale unit grew up in." So that was a surprising connection that we found out while we were actually making the movie, which was really fun.
It was an amazing journey, Kate, to get to know all of these family members and to go through their papers and ephemera and hold the letters that they had actually written in your hands, where they talk about the death of their friend or talk about how much they love their girlfriend, and the photographs too. And there were a lot of photographs that Ron and I went through, and sometimes they would sort of reveal themselves anew. You would look again and realize what you were seeing in the photograph, which then we could write to. It then enhances the story. And as much as possible, we really wanted the characters to come alive just through photographs and their spoken word. We didn't want actors moving around pretending that they were these pilots. We really wanted to bring them to life with their pictures and their words. And I feel like we succeeded.
Now, how did you go about tracking down all of these different relatives?
It's funny. They're still coming out of the woodwork. I got an email this morning and found out about two more relatives that are down in Florida. Mark had done a lot of this work initially, but sort of once the word got out. Also, most of these guys were rather wealthy and from the Northeast. And so it's not too many layers of separation to get to everybody. But Ron and I just showed a shorter version, a one-hour version of the film at the New York Historical Society. And we met a few more family members that we had never met before and you know, had never gotten a chance to interview. So it was sort of piecemeal. They're still coming up.
What were some of the biggest challenges in creating the film?
Well, raising money, certainly. You know, nobody knew who Ron and I were. We got an initial grant through one of the families for $25,000, and we went to the old Rhinebeck Aerodrome in the Hudson River Valley in New York and had a very lucky day with clouds in the sky so you could see the planes against them. And got up in the sky and filmed some of their collection of planes. And then we'd put together a little bit of the movie, wherever we had photographs already, and we had some planes, so we'd maybe get 25 minutes together. And then we'd go to New York, and we'd rent the Dolby screening room, and we'd invite people to come, hoping they would give us money. And we did this, at least half a dozen times. And, we'd get a check for $100 or something like that. But also we started a newsletter. Ron designed a beautiful letterhead. And quarterly we put out a newsletter and say, we're doing this. This is where we are. This is how far we've come. And after a couple of years, either people got tired of hearing it from us or they realized we were actually making something. So we would get in touch with family foundations that believed in the story we were making. And piece by piece, we put it together. And when we had the money, we'd bite off the next big chunk of the film. And then ultimately, we went to FedEx. Fred Smith, the founder of FedEx, was a Yale student. He formed the Yale Aero Club. He flew with the Navy, and he certainly knew the story. And FedEx came through with our finishing funds. And we were able to get the movie released on DVD and Blu-ray. And also we played the festival circuit, film festivals, and all the museums. We've played in all the big aviation and military museums around the country. We've also found our audience. It really took a while to seek out who the audience was. But by getting in touch with everybody and sending out emails and letters, we cobbled it all together.
So how difficult exactly was it to trim down the two-hour version into the one-hour museum cut?
Actually, trimming it down was not that difficult. I was very worried because we couldn't afford to bring Bruce Dern back to narrate, and I didn't know whether his narration would be able to carry us through the whole film. And so, yes, we lopped off these big pieces of the story, and some of which I hated to see go, but the film was already complete. It was already out on DVD and Blu-ray, and I just kept telling myself, well, okay, you can go back and watch the longer version of the film, and you'll be able to get that piece. It's a little narration heavy, because we also were cutting out, family members and historians to talk about the story. And so Bruce's narration luckily carries us through the whole story. And it stands alone at an hour. It really does. But there are some very emotional scenes that we had to cut out, and some of the sort of underpinnings of the characters. The characters maybe aren't quite as strong in the hour version as the 2 hour, but it depends on how much time you have to sit through a movie.
And where can people go to see the film?
Well, it's available for streaming on iTunes and Amazon Prime. You can also purchase DVDs and Blu-rays. And Ron and I are still out there showing the film. We just got into the New Haven Film Festival. I'm probably going to be showing it at the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library in the fall, and also down in Florida at a club. And also, now that we have it down to an hour, we may start shopping it around on television to see that there aren't that many TV stations that show historical documentaries anymore. But the best thing to do, I guess, would be to tune into our website at millionairesunit.org. And that'll let you know how to get the film.
Tell me a little bit about Humanis and how you got that started.
Right. So Humanis is a California nonprofit that was, initiated to serve as a vehicle for some people who had been hand raisers who wanted to make a contribution. And at that point, we had no idea if the film would be made, if it would be complete or released. We had big plans and big ideas, but we didn't really know if it would be ever see the light of day. And yet we did have a few people with their hands ready, raised, and wanting to make a contribution. So the thought there was, well, if we form a nonprofit, then they might be able to make a contribution and, write off their contribution on their taxes, since we can't guarantee them that a film is actually going to be made. So that was part of the motivation. The other part of the motivation was we had looked at the potential of going to an existing nonprofit and have them sponsor our project. And when we looked carefully at that, we realized that it might be better if we just set up our own nonprofit, not knowing all of the details that were involved in that. And details there were. And so it took a lot of effort, actually, to set up the nonprofit. But once it was set up, then we had our place where people could make contributions. And the fact of the matter is that Derek and I put in, I think, at least a year's worth of work on setting up our website with no pay. It was completely a voluntary basis. So it was really a passion project from the beginning. And we put a lot of sweat equity into it. So forming a nonprofit seemed to make sense. It worked out. And it exists to this day. And the interesting thing there is that the mission of Humanis, which began really with this one film, has expanded to many other projects. So we're currently working on a new project that Derek is co-directing called the Lafayette Escadre, about another group of flyers. And we have several other projects that are in the works with people on our board and other filmmakers. So it's really expanding. The mission of the company is really expanding over time. And we want to keep making these documentary films that have something to say about people and their contributions to significant historical events. And our president, Hugh Esten, has made it clear that the people that we're focusing on are those who have chosen to sacrifice something for the better of everyone. So that's really what we're looking at in terms of the mission.
When we completed the Millionaires Unit, I realized I wasn't done with World War I history. I had amassed quite a large library. And I also enjoyed hanging out with aviators. And nobody had done a story on the Lafayette Escadre. So the first Yale unit became the founding squadron of the U.S. Naval Air Reserve. And they were the first Americans to fly for America after America joined the war. But the Lafayette Escadre were a group of Americans, some of whom were in France already when the war broke out. And right when the war broke out, they decided they wanted to play a part and they wanted to fight for France. And so they joined the French Foreign Legion, which was the only way you could fight and not give up your citizenship as Americans, since America was neutral for the first 2.5 years of the war. And then it took about a year, but they formed an all-American squadron flying for France. And that's who the Lafayette Escadre are. So when this film is done, we will have fairly covered all of America's aviation effort in World War I, Army and Navy.
Finally, where can people go to learn more about all of Humanis' projects?
We do have a website, humanisdocumentaryfilms.org. It is lightly maintained, I would say. We're in the process right now of recruiting some people to try to help out with both our website and also our social media. We want to be able to get the word out about Humanis' projects more completely. But there is some information there on the website, give some background on our team. We have some amazing people involved, and we will be kind of working to have more current updates on there. But right now it follows the two projects that are currently being produced or have been produced. And then the other projects that are in the pipeline will be announced as they become truly viable. So we've got several that are in the works, but we don't want to really make a big splash announcement about them until they're looking like they're going to be completely viable.
We do have another website for the Lafayette Escadre, and it's thelafayetteescadre.org. And that talks a lot about the production of our film, a lot of which happened in France and also stateside. And we've already made a 20-minute version of that film. And we made it for the U.S. Centennial, the U.S. World War I Centennial Commission. And it's for their education initiative. And it's slated to be distributed to 600,000 classrooms and potentially 10 million students. So it should make a pretty big splash. So we finished the 20-minute version, and we're now working on the feature, which would be about 90 to 100 minutes.
I should just mention that on themillionairesunit.org, there's an online museum there with photographs and drawings that my grandfather did as well that are not seen in the movie. So there's actually more data on the themillionairesunit.org website, including an online museum, a timeline, and, you know, a lot of information about the movie itself. So there's, you know, plenty of data out there in addition to the actual films.
Ron and Derek, thank you for taking the time to talk today. This is Kate O'Connor reporting for AvWeb. Thanks for listening.
This podcast brought to you by Aviation Consumer Magazine, the consumer resource for pilots and aircraft owners.